And joining us on Perspectives today is J. Ryan Straddle. He is the author of the novel Kitchens of the Great Midwest. And Ryan has edits the fiction section of The Nervous Breakdown and works as acquisitions editor at Unnamed Press. He was born and raised in Minnesota, and he now lives in Los Angeles. This is his first book, but gosh, what a debut. I mean, this is an incredible book and a very different kind of book, I think, but because it's different, it really catches your attention. And this features Midwestern chef Lars Thorvald, and he has three loves in his life, his kitchen, his wife, Cynthia, and his newborn daughter, Ava. And we'll just leave it at that, and Ryan will carry us through the rest of the novel. So, Jay, thank you very much for being with us here today, taking the time to talk about your novel.
You're welcome.
As I mentioned, it's called Kitchens of the Great Midwest, and when people hear that title and they'll say, wait a minute, this is a novel? I thought it was a cookbook. I thought it was a coffee table book that everybody looks at. So how did you come up with this idea?
Growing up in the Midwest, I feel that we've got a distinct regional cuisine, and it's not always represented or understood. For example, like last year, the New York Times famously picked grape salad as the cuisine that represents Minnesota in their survey of distinctive food from each of the 50 states, and that annoyed and surprised an awful lot of Minnesotans who had never heard of grape salad and invited a whole lot of participation and people volunteering alternatives to grape salad. Chicken wild rice hot dish, tater tot hot dish, ambrosia salad even. And I thought, well, this is such a wonderful milieu to explore. I mean, no one has set a novel in the realm of specifically Midwestern cuisine that I've read so far. And when I started developing this family story, so I do feel it's a family story first and a food novel second. I thought this would be a fun realm to explore and research and delve into. That was kind of my inspiration. I, like a lot of writers, I wrote the book that I would want to read if I knew it existed, and also a book that I felt I hadn't read yet. And so going into the realm of Midwestern cuisine seemed to me like, well, okay, I'm not going to face a lot of competition here. I mean, but who knows, maybe, and it's entirely possible as well that I just don't know about the books yet that really, really cover, the fiction books anyway, that really cover Midwestern cuisine. There could be some, and, I could be standing on the shoulders of giants and not know it yet, but for me, I felt like this is largely unexplored territory for me as a writer, and it required a fair amount of research, and most of it was very pleasant, but it was a new field for me to explore, and I'm glad I did it. I certainly, on my book tour, I encounter people who make bars and other dishes from the food for the signings and events. So that's really wonderful. I really thank those people.
We're visiting with Ryan Straddle, and he is the author of the novel Kitchens of the Great Midwest. And as you mentioned earlier, Ryan, some people may think about something with this title. They think that it's perhaps a book with recipes mingled in with narrative and prose, and that is not the case. And in fact, you kind of take us on a little journey and kind of give us the history of background of certain dishes. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, that in this book, the character has three main loves, his kitchen, his wife, and his daughter. So introduce us to the family and tell us a little bit about each one.
Absolutely. Yeah. The book begins with Lars. From Lars's point of view, he's a Norwegian chef from Duluth, Minnesota, who grew up in a family where he was expected to help the family make lutefisk for Advent season. Lutefisk is a traditional Scandinavian whitefish dish that is pungent and very popular among Norwegian and Swedish communities in the Upper Midwest, particularly around Christmas. And, Lars grows up in the family bakery, grows up making lutefisk, and develops skills in the kitchen, and leaves for the Twin Cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul, and meets a aspiring sommelier named Cynthia. They get married, and they have a child, Eva. Lars is obsessed with getting Eva into the food that he enjoys. He's a little ambitious about it. I think he wants to feed her pork shoulder when she's 12 weeks old. And the pediatrician advises against it, but you know, Lars is upset. He's, you know, trying to think of ways to, you know, get Eva into the food. You know, he's like a lot of parents who have a particular passion, whether if it's music or books or cooking. You know, he just can't wait for his child to grow up enough so that he can share these things that he loves with his child. And I'm not sure if I should have any spoiler alerts here, but if you haven't read the book yet, you may want to stop listening at this second, just at least for a little while. Eva ends up largely growing up without her her parents. She's raised by her aunt and uncle, who are not foodies, who are not chefs, who don't prevent her from exploring the world of food that she was born into, but don't necessarily encourage it either. So Eva very much has to carve her own way as an aspiring chef in the world. And, you know, she doesn't know it's her birthright, in a sense. You know, she doesn't really, I think she intuitively knows, but she doesn't literally know that she was, you know, the child of a chef and a sommelier, and that her instinct towards cooking and eating and growing food was potentially passed down genetically. I mean, she's aware that she had an uncle that was a professional chef, and she's very proud of that, but she doesn't know that uncle was actually her dad. So when she explores these things, I think she feels very alone in the world and seeks out a family of choice, I'd phrase it like that, to help her along the way, you know, which does include real family members, cousins. Her cousin Brock has a chapter in the book. Subsequently, each chapter in the book is told from the point of view of another person in Eva's life. We meet that person at the moment where, you know, Eva meets them, or Eva and that person share a significant moment. And additionally, an ingredient is introduced in each of these chapters as well. And all of the ingredients and some of the people come together in the final chapter around the occasion of an extremely opulent and emotional meal in South Dakota. So it's the sort of book that I would ask readers to have a little bit of patience with, you know, because each chapter is told from the point of view of a different character, and the characters get increasingly distant from Eva as Eva grows up and becomes more infamous. So it does all come around at the end. You know, certain questions you have will get answered.
So it's basically like a recipe. You throw in all kinds of different characters, and at the end, they all mesh together and work out.
Yeah, that's right, Louis. Yeah, and there are 8 recipes in the book throughout. I mean, it's, as you pointed out, it's not a recipe book, but there are real recipes in it, and yeah, you can make them. they're actually very old school Midwestern recipes. Many of them are inspired by recipes from my great grandmother's cookbook out of Hunter, North Dakota. So these are decade old, you know, solid Midwestern farm recipes.
So that's what I was going to ask you, pardon me for interrupting, the fact that you mentioned the recipes and you talked about research at the beginning of the interview. How many of these recipes did you have to go out and research, or are they all family recipes? How did this work out?
Oh, they're all pretty much family recipes. Yeah, the only one I hadn't made was the chili oil, and that's not too difficult. A friend made it, and it turned out really well. But the other recipes, like the casserole, you know, I made that a few weeks ago. The bars are pretty easy to make. They're recipes I grew up with. So in terms of research, a lot of it just had to do with, you know, remaking these things or seeking them out or thinking about them in terms of, oh, when crucial ingredients were in season, or the price of, or the availability of certain ingredients. Because the book, you know, narratively within the realm of Midwestern food, occupies two realms, both kind of a realm that I grew up in, like the realm that there's a character named Pat Prager, who's a popular award-winning baker out of the Lutheran church tradition of bake sales and baked goods contests in the upper Midwest, contrasted with what we're experiencing nationally as a dilation of conscientiousness and consciousness as it relates to food consumption and sourcing, you know, the everything from what you'd call like farm to table to locavore movements. You know, the, all that also gets addressed in the book as well, and at times contentiously, you know, with the old guard of you know, peanut butter bars and chicken and wild rice casserole, and sometimes harmoniously. I mean, living in Los Angeles now, as I do, I see a lot of one world. But you know, Los Angeles is also arguably the most, you know, it's in California, which is arguably the most agile agricultural region in the world, and there's no shortage of great ingredients here. And so I think about that a lot in relation to Minnesota, which is in a different USDA hardiness zone, has different limitations in terms of what can be grown. You know, we can't grow citrus fruit so much up there, but rhubarb, you know, wild rice, yeah, yeah. And the accessibility to certain wild game, like venison, is really, really wonderful. And things like walleye pike, rainbow trout, you know, things like that, you can get up there that I feel like are staples of the Minnesotan's idea of Minnesotan cuisine. So, yeah, I did my best to encompass as much of it as possible, as broad a range as possible in the book. I know I couldn't cover everything. I didn't write about every kind of Midwesterner, and certainly didn't write about every kind of Midwestern food, but I did my best to try to, you know, try to not play favorites and explore the breadth of Midwestern cuisine, because I think if people haven't spent any time there, they might have a very circumscribed notion of what it is, and yeah, I wanted to disabuse that.
We're visiting with J. Ryan Stradleman. J. Ryan is the author of the novel Kitchens of the Great Midwest, and some people may be wondering whether this is perhaps a cookbook with little stories behind it, but it's a lot more than that. And I think it's interesting, as you mentioned earlier, about Eva in the book, and there's a section in the book where you're guiding the reader through the week, the weeks and age of the child, week
yeah.
one, no teeth, and you go on. And I think that's hilarious, because you come up with a, okay, what am I going to do now? Do you? She doesn't have teeth. She doesn't have this. So, how did you come up with this part here? Because it's humorous, but at the same time, for people who have children, they go, oh yeah, I know, and probably dad doesn't know, because my first grandchild, who is 6 months old, came to visit us this week, and
yeah.
I was excited about it. I went out and bought him animal cookies and all this stuff. I'm going, wait a minute, he can't eat animal cookies. He's only 6 months. I said, oh, well, okay, we'll save him for when he gets older.
That's exactly it, Louis. Yeah, no, this is Lars's first child, and even though he grew up with, you know, younger brothers, he doesn't know what childhood development is. He has no idea. He has no idea when teeth come. You know, and even though they can come at 12 weeks, I mean, I've even heard of children being born with a tooth or getting a tooth or teeth, you know, in under 12 weeks. I mean, it's an anomaly, but it's possible. He just, I don't know where he heard 12 weeks teeth, but that's what he's going with, you know. I think it is possible, like somewhere around there is, you know, certainly more likely than being born with teeth. So at least he didn't think his child would be, you know, be the, like the one in what over a thousand that has a tooth when they're born. But he's stepping in the dark. You know, he really never raised a child before, never experienced a baby. I think he maybe has seen them, been around them, but he has no idea of like what the stages of infant maturation are in terms of their readiness or ability to appreciate cuisine, or let alone digest it, you know, or chew it, you know, have any capability eat it. But so he's a little ambitious and unrealistic in his apprehension of what his daughter's capable of. And yeah, it was fun to write. I end up reading that part sometimes aloud, and you know, sometimes I get notes from people about like, oh, you know, children don't have teeth at 12 weeks or, you know. Yeah, but, you know, but Lars doesn't know that.
Right.
Yeah. And you
got
to have... He wants her to have teeth by then. Yeah, like, and so he's planning on it.
We're visiting with J. Ryan Straddle. He is the author of the recent novel, Kitchens of the Great Midwest. And one of the things that we were talking about earlier, Ryan, is the fact that, you know, people are interested in food and recipes and cookbooks. So it's not unusual for, you know, cookbooks to come out with narrative. But at the same time, who would have ever thought that we would be sitting down on the sofa watching somebody cook? Did we do that with our moms? You know, I want to be entertained, so go in the kitchen, pull up a chair, and watch mom cook.
Yeah.
So what is the catch on this? Why the interest in food channels and cookbooks and all this?
Wow. Boy, I can't really say. I do think it does come down to the fact that it's comforting.
Mm-hmm.
It's often interesting to watch people cook. I mean, I did when I was a kid. I loved to hang out in the kitchen and watch my mom make a pie or cookies. No.
Especially when you get to try the first one, right?
Yeah, yeah, and I do think that, you know, we live in a increasingly enlightened era when it comes to conscientiousness as it relates to food and ingredients, and you know we're certainly very interested in our own health and the health of people in our lives and food's role in that. I mean, I've seen evolutions in my own family in regards to attitude towards food. You know, I have relatives who, you know, used to be habitual fast food eaters that, you know, kick that habit. You know, I feel like, you know, people are a lot more conscious these days when it comes to their food consumption. But also, I think in terms of home economics, it's a lot cheaper, you know, to make food at home. And healthy food doesn't have to be expensive. I think for a long time, some of us have belabored under the illusion that, oh, you know, eating healthy is more inconvenient or more expensive. And it can be. Certainly in some cities, in some very rural areas, it can be difficult to obtain fresh fruit and vegetables. But if you're living in an urban neighborhood, you know, where you just have a, you know, either a bodega or a liquor store, you know, and the nearest grocery store is miles away, and, you know, like it can be inconvenient and costly. But I think, you know, increasingly we've I think as a society, like, taken an interest in eating healthier, and I don't know how that you know how that affects what's shown on television, but I think, you know, when I go to the gym, that's actually what I watch on the TVs at the gym. Like when I'm on the elliptical or on the treadmill, as I watch the cooking channel, you know, I could just sit there and watch a show like Chopped, you know, all day and just like lose track of how long I've been on the treadmill. And so I do think part of it does kind of go back to our childhoods or, you know, go back to a sense of just, you know, wanting to hang out with the family in the kitchen. I mean, the kitchen is such a locus of community and warmth and family. I mean, that's what it means to a lot of people.
And you know, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, in a lot of stories, television shows, and especially around the holidays, you hear the scene or watch the scene or read about the scene where everyone's in the kitchen while they're preparing some kind of meal, but that's where everybody meets and they talk and discuss about stories and everything else.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, even, you know, even as an adult out here in L.A., it's really hard to get people from congregating in the kitchen during a party, even if it's a party where food isn't served, even if it's a cocktail party or whatever. Like, people want to hang out in the kitchen. You know, it's an intimate space. People can stand close to each other. There's food available. There's drinks available. It's usually well-lit. You know, there's and it's a comforting room. It's a room where, you know, where things happen, where food gets prepared. You know, and many people prepare food out of love. You know, it's a room with a positive connotation. It's a room where a lot of children have discovered, you know, makeshift toys and learned skills. I know as a little kid, I liked to play with, you know, turkey baster, you know, like, you know, sit on the floor of the kitchen. I liked to be in the kitchen when my mom was cooking and just, like, sit on the floor and play with oven mitts and turkey basters and other things that I, you know, couldn't kill myself with. and you know, and just sit and watch her, you know, and it was, you know, it's got such a, you know, I see that word. I mean, I see the word on the, you know, on the cover of my book, and I, you know, I saved the word file as that, like, really early on when writing the book. And And it was just a nice word to look at. You know, it's a nice word to think about. And there's at least one scene in every chapter that takes place in a kitchen. And I always look forward to writing that chapter. In my life, in my world, and I think I'm not alone in this, the favorite room of the house. You know, if you took a poll of people, like for Family Feud or whatever, you know, and someone said, what's your favorite room in the house? I think most people, or at least a plurality, I don't know, I would say kitchen.
And I would say, we're visiting with Ryan Straddle, and he is the author of the book Kitchens of the Great Midwest. We were mentioning earlier about, the availability of food and how far you live from a store, growing up in the Midwest, and people who grew up in the Midwest, and even in the Southwest, where there are a lot of chili ranches and other crops available, the fact that some of these recipes are based on your grandmother's Lutheran cookbook, I would imagine that a lot of the ingredients are fresh, and they're something that would be better if you went to a market. And you living in L.A., you have access to Little Italy, Chinatown, the Mexican part of town, and there's a lot of things available for you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's just a wonderland here, Mexican ingredients, Korean ingredients, Chinese ingredients. Yeah, it's unlike anything I experienced in Minnesota. But conversely, in Minnesota, you've got, right now it's, corn season. There's been a lot of sweet corn the last couple weeks, apples, heirloom tomatoes. Rhubarb season's long gone, but, in the spring, there's a lot of rhubarb, and so you'll get that. And also, like, raspberries, things like that. And they're so close by. And even when there's, on days where there's not farmers markets, you'll be driving through a small town in Minnesota, and much like here in Southern California, you see people selling strawberries on the side of the road or right off the interstate. There's a strawberry stand, like, between here and Santa Barbara. Quite a few people selling, sweet corn out of the back of a truck in a gas station parking lot. There's a lot. There's kind of a gray market for food as well. That's really thriving up there. It's increasingly interesting to me how people in our not just in our generation, but people of our time are increasingly interested in local ingredients and supporting local farmers, and finding that often it's not just a healthy choice, but often an economical choice, and a tastier one.
Yes.
Yeah.
As we were mentioning earlier, the fact of you were saying that some Minnesotans were surprised by the fact that dish grape salad was something that was most popular, and a lot of people will find out wondering, well, what is that meal that people eat all the time in Minnesota, or what did early settlers eat in Iowa, in Oregon, in the Old West? And because of that, you can bring those old stories and tie them into the recipes. And what you just mentioned earlier about your grandma's Lutheran cookbook, there are a lot of organizations and churches in particular who used to bring together cookbooks to pass out and to sell. And there's a lot of history behind some of those cookbooks.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and there are also kind of a history of that region, what that region was able to access at the time. For example, I remember my grandma canning peaches a lot. Peaches aren't a Minnesota crop. Where do you get the peaches from? She said from Colorado. Apparently, they couldn't wait in North Dakota, in the part of North Dakota they lived in, they couldn't wait to get the shipments of peaches from Colorado. Apparently, Colorado has had a fairly robust, peach crop. And I didn't know that until I actually spoke with my grandmother when researching this novel about where do you get your peaches? I guess it makes sense in some ways, the nearest state to North Dakota that grew peaches, and so they would wait for that crop to come in and wait for those peaches to be delivered to North Dakota, and they would eat some, fresh, and then they would can the rest and have them, over the winter for so long, for much of our nation's history. People were locavores or ate farm to table without the without the you know, without those phrases attached. I mean, they were, you know, self-evident or just unnecessary. It's yeah, like, yeah, my dad would, you know, my dad is basically a locavore right now, and I don't know if he knows the phrase exists. He's, you know, he wouldn't care if it does. Like, that's yeah, and it's funny how there's such a conscious emphasis on that in a lot of urban eateries in some of our larger cities, and especially in some of the what's regarded as the hipper neighborhoods. But you know that said, you know, people have been, you know, eating like this for as long as people have existed, and it's interesting that it's sort of being commodified now. I mean there are earnest returns to it, you know, like you shouldn't have to pay $34 for a, you know, locally grown rhubarb pie. And I bet you can if you want to. I bet you can find that place that'll sell it to you for that price. But
yeah. We are visiting with Jay Ryden Straddle. He is the author of the novel Kitchens of the Great Midwest. And we have about a minute and a half left here, Ryan. So if you wouldn't mind directing us to perhaps a webpage or Facebook, whatever, they can find out more about your book and a little bit more about yourself.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I've got a website at jryanstradal, jryanstradal.com. Also on Facebook, the same. Twitter, the same. Instagram, the same. Just J. Ryan Straddle, all put together. No dots, no dashes, no uppercase, all together. And Instagram, I do try to concentrate on like a lot of the food I come across. I'm going to be going to the State Fair of Minnesota pretty soon, in a couple weeks. And I'll, you know, try to take some photographs there. And but overall, yeah, thank you. If you check any of it out, I thank you in advance. I really appreciate it.
Well, we want to thank you very much for taking the time to be with us. We've been visiting with Jay Ryan Straddle, author of Kitchens of the Great Midwest. Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Eddie Rosales. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Luis Sainz.